Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight in studio, we have Maxwell B. Pearl, a transgender man who transitioned about 2 years ago. Hello, Max.
Hi.
Well.
Hi, it's really great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're so glad you're with us, Maxwell. When we met Max, he was a woman living in a lesbian relationship, and we had them on our show a couple times. And now that Max is Max, we are really looking forward to learning how he came to be in his own. How did you come to be, Max? And I'm sure our listeners are wondering that themselves. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of August 4th, 2019. For the first time, Russia has used its 2013 federal law prohibiting, quote, propaganda of non-traditional sexual relationships, end quote, to split a male same-sex couple from their legally adopted 12 and 14-year-old sons. The fathers brought their sons to a Moscow hospital in June over a suspected case of appendicitis. Doctors then alerted the investigative committee of Russia, and the committee later charged the adoption agency with negligence for allowing the kids to be adopted by a gay man in 2010. The committee's report on the matter said, quote, a man has been raising two young adopted boys since 2010 in living conditions with another man. At the time, he promotes unconventional relations, forming distorted ideas about family values and children, harming their health, moral, and spiritual development. Local activists worry that if the agency was found guilty, the ruling could be used to annul the adoption and possibly split up the family. Their worries were founded because even though the ruling hasn't been issued yet, Russian authorities have already split up the couple from their adopted sons. And here in the U.S., a new study from Zillow shows that gay-centric neighborhoods bring higher property values and selling prices. Up to 294% more value for a home compared with those in surrounding metro areas. This according to the analysis of 36 housing markets released last May. Residences in West Palm Springs boast a hefty 233% premium compared to the average price of homes in Riverside County. Palm Springs has the highest percentage of same-sex couples in California, according to an analysis of U.S. Census data by the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. Guerneville here in Sonoma County and West Hollywood rank second and third, respectively, in the number of same-sex couples per 1,000 households. According to the Zillow study, West Hollywood carries a 32.9% neighborhood premium, with a local home valued at $203,000 more than other areas of L.A. County. The survey found that 43% of residents identified as LGBTQ, 33% identifying as gay males. Cleveland's Riverside neighborhood carries the study's top dividend of 293%. And earlier this year, we reported on a new law in California that requires all law enforcement officers and 911 dispatchers to complete LGBT awareness training. The Police Academy at Napa College took a lead in providing this statewide training and announced they'll be hosting a national conference on the subject for law enforcement personnel across the United States. The conference will take place next April at the college, and the speakers, who include Judy and Dennis Shepard, parents of Matthew Shepard, and other experts, will be flying in from around the country. The Police Academy hopes to fill the conference with 200 attendees. The goal of this new law and the conference is to strengthen law enforcement's relationship with the LGBTQ community. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
Hey, Greg, before we get to our interview for tonight, I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about the conference. It sounds really amazing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really exciting, and I'm really proud that Napa Valley College is going to be hosting it. You know, as I mentioned in the news segment, we're hoping to draw law enforcement officers from around the country. We have seats for 200. So the whole idea here is to share what we're doing in California with law enforcement agencies throughout the United States. It's going to be a pretty, it's going to be a pretty cool 3 days.
Wow. And have you started advertising? I mean, have people been interested in it? Or
yeah, well, we started pre-registration, or an early bird registration, rather, this month. And so I've already gotten 16 people that have paid their fees and are ready to go. And
wow.
I was a little bit surprised about where they came from. Most of the registrants so far are from outside of California.
Interesting.
So I think it's going to draw a lot of people from out of California, but certainly we hope that we get a room full of California people too.
Right. Well, how did this law come about to make it make this conference happen? I mean,
yeah, you know, laws don't get passed very quickly, but I was stunned at how fast this went through. It actually originated from an idea that Equality California had some time back about getting a law passed to require law enforcement training. And they had approached a legislator with wanting to put a law together on the basis of something that happened in San Jose several years ago involving a bathroom raid. And it really wasn't a good idea, or a good reason anyway, to create this law. So my colleague at San Jose PD reached out to me and said, hey, we think this is a good idea, but we don't think putting it on the back of something that happened 5 years ago is the best reason for it. So we met with Assemblymember Evan Lowe, who represents a district in South San Francisco, and proposed this idea to him about carrying a law that would require training for law enforcement on LGBT awareness, various topics. And his office was really supportive, so I actually had the honor, I'm going to call it, to draft the bill for him.
What?
Yeah. So the law was actually drafted in February of last year. It moved all the way through the legislature without too many hiccups, and the governor signed it into law on September 30th of 2018. So I've never seen anything move that fast. It went through, and it's really its first time through the legislature. So on January 1st, this law went into effect, and it applies to all law enforcement officers and 911 dispatchers in the state of California.
So you're hoping that people from outside of California attend so that maybe they can take the ideas back to their states?
Exactly. Because, you know, we think it's important in California, but the reasons that we think it's important in California don't just apply to our state. We really think that law enforcement across the nation should be trained. And the reality of it is, I know very few departments that provide LGBT awareness training for their staff. I don't know any that provide that level of training for dispatchers.
Uh-huh. It's an interesting concept. I mean, I really never even gave it much thought. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
By the way.
Thanks. I'm really proud of it. And I think anybody who's been LGBT or Q in law enforcement and has had to live closeted while working in the profession understands how desperately this training is needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of LGBTQ law enforcement officers, what are workplaces like for them?
You know, in California, I think it's probably different than in most other parts of the country. I mean, there have been a couple of studies done by UCLA's Williams Institute down south. One was in 2013 and one in 2015. And we actually used that data as evidence to justify the need for this training. But both of those studies concluded that homophobia was pervasive throughout law enforcement. Now, that's not to say that in every agency in California that's going to be true. There are certainly some places here and there that are really supportive of LGBT employees. But, you know, even in departments like San Francisco, where you just assume that every gay or lesbian officer is going to be accepted, homophobia exists. There was a couple of lawsuits that have been published in the paper, one just recently by a young officer who's been out since he was a teenager. His mom is in the command staff at San Francisco PD, and he has suffered tremendously. You know, in that department. So, you know, it can happen in any place. But there are departments like San Rafael. I would say Santa Rosa PD has a pretty good reputation of being very supportive of gay and lesbian officers.
Mm-hmm. So you would say probably then it'd be different here in the North Bay maybe than in other places in the state?
Well, I think there are agencies here in the North Bay where it's better. But I would also say, you know, LA Sheriff's Office has a reputation of being a pretty accepting place. LAPD, you know, two huge agencies have done a lot of work to try to create an inclusive workplace, and they have been probably more successful than most agencies. But, you know, most police departments have less than 50 people working for them, so they're small. And if there is an officer who is out, they are really a very small minority of the workforce. And they're still rare, you know, throughout the industry. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, you know, in terms of training and awareness and dispelling a lot of the stereotypes that are out there about what it means to be LGBT and be a cop.
Right. And this is not only about, you know, being safe in the workplace and accepting and stuff. It's also serving the public who might be LGBT.
Exactly. I mean, with marriage equality now, there are more and more couples who are married. And so the chances of getting a call for a domestic violence situation are higher. I mean, domestic violence exists in the LGBT community as much as it does in the straight community. So officers need to be aware, they need to be trained, and they need to understand that relationships are relationships. But there's a lot of stereotypes around same-sex relationships that I think can influence how an officer would respond and cause them to respond inappropriately. So one of the requirements of this law is that there be some specific discussion about how to respond to domestic violence involving same-sex couples. And then the same is true for hate crimes. You know, hate crimes motivated by sexual orientation are the second most common bias motivation in California. And if law enforcement officers aren't really trained to detect those crimes, they may go unreported.
I'm remembering our Pride Festival, Greg, earlier this summer, and you brought three young men to the festival, and I interviewed them for our Voices at Pride show.
Right.
And they, all three of them, had never been to a Pride Festival. They were so open. They just seemed like a new world had been opened to them. And I want to invite the listeners to go back and listen to that show if they'd like to hear, you know, three of your students.
Tell us
real quick what you do at Napa Valley College.
Yeah, so these were three cadets in our law enforcement academy, the Basic Police Academy. They're going to work in different places throughout the Bay Area. I recall one was going to work in Stockton, one for Oakland Housing Authority as a police officer. So we require the students to research a culture that they're unfamiliar with. They choose the culture on their own. Sexual orientation or gender identity, aspects of the LGBT community, are some of the options open to them. So the three students that you met chose the LGBT community for this project, and it requires them to immerse themselves somehow, to talk with three members of the community in a face-to-face conversation, and then they come back to their class and provide training. So that's how we accomplish the cultural diversity training in the academy, is we have the students go out and learn through experience and then come back and teach their peers.
I think you are doing such a fabulous job in helping the police officers of in your world to be a little more educated in these issues, Greg. I can't commend you enough. The work you're doing at Napa Valley College, this conference you're putting on. I'm assuming you're putting it on, yes?
Yeah. I have some great partners that I'm working with, but I'm really proud of it too. I get a lot of support, so that's what makes it happen. I mean, I certainly couldn't do it all on my own if I didn't have the support of our college and the academy and a lot of officers from the area working on this. So I'm excited about it too, and I am proud of what we do in terms of educating officers on particularly how to understand and engage better with LGBT people. The most impressive thing that happens to me through these experiences is when one of our students is able to come out. And I would argue that we're probably one of the most LGBT-friendly academies in the state, but it's still hard, even in that environment, for young people to be who they are and to bring them their whole selves to work.
Well, I applaud you in the work you're doing and the safety that you create in your classroom. And can people contact you if they want to volunteer or get involved somehow? How would they contact you?
I think the easiest thing for people to do would just be to go to my radio show's website, outbeatnews.com. There's a contact link at the very top, and you can just drop a quick note right there. It'd be great.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for speaking with me before we get back to our interview of the evening, Greg.
Of course.
Thanks again for all your hard work.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. In studio, we have Maxwell B. Pearl, a transgender man, as our guest tonight. Welcome back, Max. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here, and it's fun to be back after a few years.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
So I've been actually a software developer for many years, and that's primarily what I'm doing right now. And I also have been writing science fiction in the past, although not as much now. I live in Petaluma with my new partner. And yeah, life is in many ways simpler than it was, which is nice.
Well, how is it simpler?
I think being more authentic in myself means that a lot of complexity that I created because I was trying to fit a box that didn't really quite work is gone. I don't need it anymore. And so things feel a lot simpler, a lot easier.
I'm imagining by listening to what you're saying, when you say things are a little simpler and you don't have to fit in a box, I imagine what you're saying is that it's just easier to be yourself.
Yeah, it's easier to live my life as me.
Yeah.
I'm not always trying to figure out, oh, why is this not working, or why is this not feeling right, or why is this group of people not feeling like the right fit for me, or why is this thing not working for me, or trying to explain all of that. And I don't have to do that anymore. So it's just me living my life.
Huh.
It's kind of fun, actually.
Uh-huh. Did you have any idea? I mean, when you asked the question, like, am I in the right place? Who are these people I'm with? Like,
I think for many years, I spent a lot of years trying to figure out why things weren't quite working, like why I wasn't feeling like I was in the right place or doing the right thing or being the right person. And I always was gender nonconforming since I was a kid. I mean, pretty much the minute I could choose my own clothing, I was choosing boys' clothing. And once I left the house, I always sort of bought men's clothing. And that sort of worked for me, but I didn't really go further than that. And of course, I chose to be a scientist and chose to do things that were sort of generally the sphere that was, especially since I'm older, sort of more male-oriented. But I also spent many years, certainly in my older adult, 30s and onward, like working to accept me as I was. And so the dots didn't quite connect for a long time. And when they finally did, it was like, oh, that was what it was. That was what I needed.
When did the dots start connecting? Was it social? Like the kids who are coming up now? Was it like the language changing?
So part of it was language. Part of it was that when in the 90s and early aughts, when genderqueer first became sort of, and also just the trans people being able to talk about being trans more and the language changed, that opened a door for me. And then also in the last 10 years or so, I met a lot more trans men. And so that experience, because I hadn't known any until probably about 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. So it's like I hadn't known what that was. I hadn't really known that experience. So meeting people and knowing people. A good friend of mine has a good friend who transitioned about 6 years ago. And so watching them go through that was it's like, oh, okay, I can see this. It makes sense to me. So it was a combination of opening doors and also the acceptance thing. It is great to accept yourself as you are, but the piece that was critical for me was accepting that I had dysphoria. And instead of like, okay, I have this thing, this dysphoria, and so I need to accept me as I am and sort of ignore the dysphoria. That was what I did for many, many years. But then I finally accepted the dysphoria, and that also opened the door to like, okay, I can do something about the dysphoria.
Could you define dysphoria for our listeners?
Yeah, dysphoria is the sense that your body is different, it should be different than it is. So you should have parts you don't have or you shouldn't have parts that you have. And it's a physical, it's a very embodied physical feeling. It's not up here. It's in the body. It's hard to describe. I think for people who are cis, it's just something that's hard to understand because it's not a living experience that you have.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by cis?
By cis is people who are totally aligned with the gender they're assigned to at birth. So they feel their bodies are right. It's like, of course, this is the body I have, and this is fine. This works. This, you know.
So tell me, you're describing dysphoria, and mm-hmm. I'm thinking in my mind, maybe a listener or two uh-huh. are thinking the same thing. Uh-huh. So you're saying you're feeling one way, and then when you look at yourself, it's like doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm
good way to describe it.
So as I get older, I look in the mirror and go, what the heck? Where did all these wrinkles come
yes.
from? That is not me. I am too young.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Kind of like that.
Yeah. It's actually kind of like that. Yeah. Actually.
Like you're surprised in the mirror every
right.
time because you don't feel
totally.
That way.
Yes,
totally.
Exactly.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
what is dysphoria in the DSM? Is it like
it is? I mean, I'm not a psychologist. So,
yeah.
You know, and I'm not like up on the, you know, most recent. Stuff on this.
But you're speaking to it. That's
yeah.
That's
but it is.
Is
in the DSM. Mm-hmm. I think it's called
gender
sure
dysphoria.
I think it's gender dysphoria. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think yeah, that's what it's still called. I try not to go to that book if I don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, there's
you
all
know
sorts
what
of,
I mean.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds
all sorts
so
of questions about well, is it?
Yeah.
Should it be in the DSM? And,
yeah. So yeah, it's just feeling different. Just feeling not yourself. Not,
yes.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So how long did you feel not, how long did you feel that
as
you weren't aligned?
As long as I can remember.
Did you wish you were a boy when you were growing up?
I did, but it didn't really sink in like it. For some people have the experience where they mm-hmm. they know, you know, I'm a boy, and they know that. I didn't know that. I think part of the reason I didn't know that is that I am somewhat gender complex. I mean, I do feel like even though I've chosen outwardly to be a man and to live as a man, my gender is not quite that simple. I mean, for some people it is simple. Mm. For me, it's not. I think I actually do have, you know, they're sort of both in me in some way, but I've chosen to live as a man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of the reason why it wasn't so crystallized for me as a kid or earlier on.
And maybe it shouldn't be.
I mean, there's all sorts of theories about this, but I think there's all sorts of theories that gender actually is a spectrum and people can be, you know, one, the other, multiple, both, neither, somewhere in between, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's about comfortability. It's about who, you know, feeling good in our skin. And that's
yeah.
what it should be about,
yep.
really, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what most people are trying to do away with the labels, but yet we are adding more labels and more initials and more,
uh-huh.
you know, to the LGBTQ and all of
yeah.
that, you know.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, I think as we, as a society, get more accepting mm. of any kind of, you know, divergence from what is considered the, you know, heteronormative, you know, cis heteronormative norm or whatever, mm. I think that opens the door for what the wide range really is.
Mm.
And I think that's great. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll get to a point where it doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. You're just who you are, and you're whatever combination of stuff you are. And that's okay.
Well, people are really pushing toward that, but that's a woo!
It's,
you know, that's
yeah,
a,
it's a ways
yeah,
away.
I mean,
it's
yeah,
a ways away.
But the way the politics are these days. You know?
I have a friend who has a 12-year-old and mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, and she was telling me about the education that this 12-year-old is getting. I mean, of course, it's a progressive school, but the 12-year-old, they have this thing called there's this gender spectrum thing, and they get taught like about the spectrum, and they can choose like where they are in terms of their biological sex and where they are in terms of their gender and where they are in terms of their gender presentation, and they get to decide.
Wow.
And I'm like, this, I mean, it's like amazing, you know, and so there's a lot of hope for the future generations around this, because they just are and they get to just be.
So you mentioned something earlier when you were talking and mm-hmm. living your life as a man, and you said something about it being more fun. So what's fun about it
well,
for you?
Fun, I guess fun is that because I'm not working to figure out why I'm not fitting, I get to just have joy in life as it is. And I get to just be and live my life and just, Yeah, and it just, so everything is more everything is more enjoyable because there isn't that layer of figuring stuff out or feeling weird about where I am or anything like that.
I mean, yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But as you speak, I'm thinking it's just, it seems to me it's like the coming out process for someone who feels like they're gay.
Yes.
You know, they're trying to be straight. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel right.
Yep.
And then they finally come out as like, whoa, okay.
Totally. It's very much the same. Yep. It's very much the same.
And you can relate that to being in a racist environment and leaving the racist environment and coming over here.
Yes.
Like the freedom, and I felt that many times, right? It's like, whoa, that weight.
The freedom of just getting to be ourselves and not having to be wary about, you know, what other people are thinking or doing or, that's really great.
So I would like to learn more about the decision. This is what the plan is.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, we're going to talk about the journey with you and as a lesbian and, you know, the stepping into this new life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I as I said, I spent many years just trying to accept my body as it was. And it wasn't, and I sort of get a little bit better and a little bit better, but it didn't actually ever take. I never really felt like I could fully do it. And then I came to a place where I had to accept my dysphoria. And I was like, okay, let me accept that. And then in fully like grappling with that and saying, yes, this exists. Yes, this is here. I realized, oh, this is something I actually can do something about. I don't have to just live with this. And so, and I wasn't sure, I knew that I was going to get top surgery because that was a place where I had really huge dysphoria and it was very difficult for me. And so, but I didn't know what else I would do. I didn't really have a sense of would I choose to live as a man, or I was just sort of taking it step by step. And actually I went on a retreat, which I want to talk a little bit about because it's called Transmission, which is a retreat for genderqueer transmasculine people who were assigned female at birth. And I get to meet a lot of people who were on their various paths of choosing to be non-binary, choosing to be men, choosing, you know, being on their journey. And that was a really transformative experience for me because I got to see all of the different options that, you know, that I could and all the different paths, and also talk to people who were on various paths. And so it was just sort of step by step. It's like, what feels right? The name Max, actually, I've had for a long time. It was a character in a book I wrote a while ago, but I've always liked it. And it's always been sort of an alter ego name for me online. And so as I sort of stepped on this journey, it was like, oh, I'm the Max. This is who I am. And so I just sort of, as I lived into it more, I realized, actually, you know, it would be best for me to live my life as a man. Even though I have some gender complexity, that felt like this would be the most authentic way to live my life. And so I chose to start testosterone. That was almost 2 years ago. And that was, you know, one can make a decision about living as a man and having top surgery, but testosterone is biological. It changes you in ways I didn't predict and didn't. I mean, it's still like a fascinating thing for me as an all, because I have a background in neuroscience, and so it's fascinating the ways that changing my brain, and we can talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
But that decision was sort of propelled other ones because it's such an embodied thing to do that. So. Yeah, so that was sort of the process that I went through.
Wow, so there's so much.
I know. So while you're there, I would like to know how the testosterone changed your brain. And
it's fascinating. I mean, it's because what testosterone does is it has a few effects, one of which is to bring on the secondary sex characteristics of men. And that means my voice got low really fast. Really fast. And it's still lowering a little bit, but I think it's pretty much at its point. And as you can see, I have facial hair.
Mm-hmm.
It changed it changes the shape of my face so I don't look the same. If you look at pictures of me, I mean, I look at pictures of me often in the past and before and after and in between, and my face looks different. It redistributes your fat in your body, and so it moves fat actually mostly here, which is, you know.
where's here for the listeners?
It's abdomen.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, get a bit of a pot belly.
Yeah.
Goes from the hips to the pot belly. So, I mean, I think people haven't done a lot of research on this, and I want to dive into it because it's fascinating. But it does change some things about the way my brain works. Some of it is also hard to distinguish between what is changes in my brain and what is, you know, sort of that interaction of society seeing me as a man and the way that I respond to that, mm-hmm. that knowing that people are seeing me as a man. So it's hard to know, like, what's actually in my brain, what's just my psychological reaction response. To what how people are seeing me. And it's hard to distinguish. But some some very specific changes have happened around attraction. Like, for me in the past, attraction wasn't located visually. It was located usually in how someone talked or how, you know, what I knew about their personality or what I knew about their life or how smart they were. Or it was sort of a combination of many things. Mm-hmm. But now attraction begins visually. It mm-hmm. never used to begin visually. Now it begins visually. Which is fascinating to me because I'd like noticed that change in real time. It's like over time, it's like the visual aspect became so much more prominent for me, which is weird. I mean, it's just an interesting change in the way that my brain responds to people.
You know, you said you're a scientist and you didn't really say much about that in the beginning, but you uh-huh. are talking like a scientist, like you're doing
yes.
research
right.
on the whole phenomenon.
Yes, yes.
It's yeah. amazing. Are yeah. you keeping notes?
I've been writing a little bit about it, not a lot, but I probably should write more and do some research because it's a fascinating thing to me to notice for myself. And of course, it's also, you know, it's always an experiment of one because, and this is true for anybody who takes testosterone or any trans woman who take estrogen, because it is different. It depends on genetics. It mm-hmm. depends on how old you are. It depends on so many different factors. So it's always sort of in a way an experiment mm-hmm. of one, how things shift for you, whether it's in your body or in your brain. The other big change, which might be more of a societal interaction than in brain per se, but there may be a piece of that, is how much space I'm willing to take up. You know, before, I think living as a woman, I mean, certainly I think we were trained as women to not take up space, to, you know, to be deferent, to try to please people. And I noticed that now it's like I'm willing to take up space. I actually don't care what people think. I mean, it's just, it's a fascinating, I mean, I do care, but you know what I mean? I mean, there's this way in which I don't defer. It's not automatic anymore. It's just a fascinating thing. And I think there is a societal interaction there because people give me space. So I think because I'm given space, it may be that, oh, now I can like take more of it up. But people give me space. People give me their attention in ways they never used to before. And that's another piece, fascinating piece as well.
Right. I mean, you wow. are really, I mean, that's one of my questions was like, well, now you have male privilege.
I do have male privilege.
And you are describing male privilege, and it is fascinating to
yes.
listen to.
Yes.
However, we do have to take a music break.
Okay.
And we will get back to this very fascinating
okay.
subject after the
For
song.
Sure. I'm ready to go. Roll with this
could
one,
you,
honey.
Max, uh-huh. could you introduce the song that you brought and tell us why
yeah,
you brought it?
I brought the song Better Together by Jack Johnson. And it's a song that I actually chose for my new partner. It's a sweet song. It's about, you know, difficulties in life, but that they're better when you deal with things together. And so, yeah, that's why I chose the song.
Enjoy.
There's no combination of words I could put on the back of a postcard. No song that I could sing, but I can try for your heart. Our dreams, and they are made out of real things, like a shoebox of photographs with sepia tone loving. Love is the answer, at least for most of the questions of my heart, like why are we here and where do we go, and knock on us so hard. It's not always easy, and sometimes life can be deceiving. I'll tell you one thing, it's always better when we're together. It's always better when we're together. Yeah, we'll look at them stars when we're together. Well, it's always better when we're together. Yeah, it's always better when we're together. moments just might find their way into my dreams tonight. But I know that they'll be gone when the morning light sings or brings new things. For tomorrow night you see that they'll be gone too. Too many things I have to do. But if all of these dreams might find their way into my day-to-day scene, I'd be under the impression I was somewhere in between. With only two, just me and you, not so many things we got to do or places we got to be. We'll sit beneath the mango tree now. Yeah, it's always better when we're together. We're somewhere in between together. Well, it's always better when we're together. Yeah, it's always better when we're together. Combination of words I could say, but I will still tell you one thing, we're better together.
And if you just joined us, you are listening to Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan, and our guest is Maxwell B. Pearl, and he just brought this song that we played for you called Better Together by Jack Johnson. Welcome back, everybody. We were talking before the music break about male privilege, which you are enjoying. You described not only taking more space than you did as a woman, but people are giving you space. Can you be a little more descriptive and tell us what that feels like, looks like? Because Diana and I, we wouldn't know what that would be like.
Yeah. You know, there's the complexity, of course, that I'm a black man. And so I have male privilege, but only to a certain point. It shows itself up more when I'm on the phone and also in my work life, than it does sort of in person on the street. But when I'm, especially in work, as I talk to people, they assume that I know what I'm talking about. I never get patronized. I never get, well, you won't understand this, or I know this might be hard, or whatever. It's always, they just assume that I know what I'm talking about. It's easier for me to admit I don't know I don't know something, because they'll just assume I can learn it, as opposed to oftentimes with women in tech, it's like this assumption that women aren't as good at it, and so they'll never learn it. So it's much easier to do my work because I can be just honest about what's happening, and I can just say, hey, I'm stuck with this or whatever, and I still get what I'm going to get paid attention to. When I talk to customer service on the phone, they are much more deferent, and things happen more quickly. You know, in person, it's a mix because I'm black, so there's that mix. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a... Well, I think there is often a wariness that women have around men, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel that wariness, and I'm not sure, is that wariness because I am a man, or is that wariness because I'm black? No. I don't know what that, I can't really distinguish that. I think I felt it less as a woman, because I do think black women are not considered as dangerous in a way, or not as threatening. And so I often notice that if I'm dealing with, like when I'm dealing with this, the guy in the auto parts store or whatever, that there's just this assumption that I know what I'm doing, and they're gonna be deferent to me, and they're gonna give me what I need, and I'm not gonna be patronized. Mm-hmm. And so it's real.
Thank you for this knowledge, because we've had several transgender men on, and we haven't had this detail of a experience, and we are really appreciating it.
I think it also is, there's a range of experience for trans men around this, because I can pass pretty easily as cis. People don't actually, when they see me on the street, they don't actually question. Whereas for many trans men, it's different. They might not have, they might not have a lot of facial hair. They might be small. Their voice might have not, you know, so I think it really does range. I think trans men that I've talked to who can pass have had this experience. So, but I think it's not true for all trans men, for sure.
Well, speaking of privilege, I have one other question about privilege. And that's heterosexual privilege that you are now no doubt enjoying.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. It's a little odd. First of all, it's odd because both of us identify as queer. And so even though we're in a visually heterosexual relationship, we both identify as queer. And so it doesn't feel like to us that it's heterosexual. But out in the world, people assume. And also just to say, my new partner oftentimes, especially in Northern California, looks kind of like a lesbian. So it you know, it's a little bit
complex. How does a lesbian look?
Don't start trouble.
she kind of looks like a Butch Dyke, I mean, honestly. So I mean, so that complexifies it a little bit. When we're outside of the Northern California bubble, people do much more quickly assume that we're a straight couple. But the Northern California bubble makes things a little bit people are like, what are they doing together? You know.
How does she identify? I'm just curious.
As queer.
Just
queer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a label other than that. Okay.
Yeah, just queer. I have been, I had an experience where I was traveling with a good friend of mine she's a lesbian but does not ring the gaydar for people. And it was fascinating because we were traveling together and we're good friends, so we've known each other for a long time. And I was the one who got the check in the restaurant. I was the one who got poured the wine. And also I noticed that for myself, I noticed a layer of wariness. It was one of the first times that I had sort of been out and about with somebody. And I noticed that there was a wariness that I had that I didn't have to have. We were in Monterey, and so it was sort of outside of the queer bubble of this area. And it was a wariness I didn't have.
Like, well, describe it.
I think in the past, when I was with somebody who could have been perceived as my lesbian partner, I think it was sort of like, well, how are people perceiving us? And should we be careful? And should we not do, you know, PD, public displays of affection? And you're sort of putting a guard around yourself because you know that it may not be safe. And I realized that I hadn't put that guard around myself and I didn't have to because people would just, even though she's a friend and a lesbian, people wouldn't think that and they just think that we were a heterosexual couple traveling.
And how did that make you feel?
It was weird. I mean, on one hand, it was nice not to have that guard up. And on the other hand, I was like, well, this is annoying and sort of stupid. I mean, you know, because I do think that that's, this process has taught me that although it's nice to have male privilege and it's nice to have heterosexual privilege, I don't like the fact that that exists. So on one hand, yeah, it makes my life easier. On the other hand, it's like, well, that's not right, you know, that sort of juxtaposition.
Yeah, thank you for saying that because I'm kind of like irritated on one hand because I know it exists, but you get to experience how that is, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
So we had a friend maybe 20, 25 years ago who was a lesbian in a lesbian relationship. And then she fell in love with a man. And so being with this man, they're still together, she lost a lot of friends, a lot of lesbian friends who felt like she, quote unquote, sold out.
Right. Yes.
So I'm curious about your friends, your family, when you transitioned, if you had any of that fallout or...
So for the most part, I didn't. I did lose a few friends, mostly not close friends. All of my close friends I still have and were very accepting. And most of them were like, oh, yeah, of course. It's like, you know, I'm not surprised. You know, nobody was really surprised. My family was surprisingly wonderful about it. My parents were really sweet. And that was a relief. I didn't know how they react. They were a little perplexed for a little bit, but they have been trying really hard to use my name, and they actually have it now, and they use my pronouns, although they mess up sometimes, but they're 80, you know, I mean, so actually they're older than that. My dad's 92, so they've been really sweet. But there were a few friends that I lost. You know, there is a thankfully small but significant portion of the lesbian community that has a hard time with transgender people, and a few of my friends fit into that category. Mm. And they didn't actually say much. They just disappeared. They just sort of evaporated from my life, which is fine. I think I'd rather just them evaporate than them sort of, I didn't want to hear what they had to say.
So they have a problem with trans people, period?
They primarily have a problem with trans women, and they don't see trans women as women. They're not willing to see them as authentic. I think for some lesbians, there's a narrative about trans men, sort of this whole thing about losing the butches, you know. And it's what's interesting about that is I was actually never a butch. And so, and it's been, it has been interesting, you know, although I identified as a lesbian and I lived as a lesbian for many years. And, you know, and as you know, even sort of did work in the lesbian community. I never really quite felt like I fit. And I realized in retrospect, it was the best fit at the time, but it wasn't actually the right fit. And this is a much better fit. I mean, it is actually the right fit. And it's a little bit odd to think about, well, what did that past mean? And it meant a lot to me at the time, but I also realized that I wasn't actually a lesbian. And it's an odd thing to say because I identified as one and lived as one, but I wasn't actually lesbian. I was a man, but I wasn't quite there yet all those years. So,
speaking of being a lesbian, mm-hmm. So before that's what we knew you, and you're in partnership mm-hmm. and doing mm-hmm. the groups and
yes.
all of that.
Yep.
So
yep.
What happened in that
span? So my ex, Ruth, mm-hmm. is still doing some of that work, and it's still going on. And some of the work that we did together is still living on, and it's still in my old name, and that's fine with me. I don't think my transition changes anything about the work we did. I think it was good work and continues to be good work, and she continues to do it. People have found it really valuable, and I'm happy that people still find value in it. It makes it a little bit more complex, and I think it is true that there were, between the fact that we broke up and the fact that I transitioned, I think there were some people who felt like what we were doing must not have been right because this mm-hmm. happened. But what we were doing was always about learning about and accepting yourself as you are and being self-responsible and learning how to communicate. It was never about fitting into a particular structure.
In other words, the words that you and Ruth, the work you did, the words you said are still true to this day.
Absolutely.
You're just in a different form.
Yep, absolutely.
So you were still being authentic.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
May I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Like all this is personal, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
I mean, was that the reason why the breakup?
No.
We know couples have broken up
yeah,
because of the
that's
transition.
True, but this was not the reason. No, it was much more complex. I mean, I think that was a little piece of it, mm-hmm. but that was not the major piece of it. We actually broke up before I decided mm-hmm. to fully transition.
Well, I think I agree with you, Cher. I think it'd be important for you to start writing this book. We know you're a writer. You got to put this stuff down, but this uh-huh. is intriguing.
Uh-huh.
Really, really
yeah,
intriguing.
It is. It's,
and the
it
way
is,
you speak about it, too.
It's been an interesting journey. I think also transitioning later in life. I mean, I was 57 when I decided to transition. I'm turning 60 this year. It's a different experience than people who decide to transition when they're 25 and a different set of things. It's been fine with me, but for many trans people, they leave their old life totally behind. And that's not something I've been able to do in the same way because my previous life is so long and I have so much, you know, there. I can't do that in the same way. And that's actually been okay. Yeah, it's a different experience transitioning this late, later in life.
How have your coworkers and your job and...
So, as you remember, I was doing work with my ex, Ruth, on this thing called Conscious Girlfriend, which we were doing full-time. I had left doing software development. I took a break from that, and I'm back doing that again with mostly new people, with new... I'm a contractor for new companies, and so people are not connected to that old work. I mean, they may Google me and know, but So it's a different set of
people. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Not entirely, but largely. So it's a new iteration of the software development work. Some people know I'm trans, some people don't. If they Googled me, they'd know, but you know, I don't necessarily say, "Hey, just so you know." I just do the work. So.
We have a friend who's a trans man also, and he's in Texas right now having a reunion with five of his friends who transitioned all at the same time, and they get together once a year.
Oh, that's great.
And you mentioned a retreat for trans people and how important that was to you, getting together with other trans people.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about
that? I will. Yeah. There's an organization called Transmission, which I am on the leadership team of now. It puts on retreats 2 or 3 times a year in Northern California. And they are retreats for transmasculine, genderqueer, non-binary people who are AFAB, that's assigned female at birth. You know, 3 or 4 days in the woods. Usually it's held at Saratoga Springs, which is a retreat center that's pretty well known in the queer community up here in Upper Lake. And it's workshops and circles where people talk about what's going on with them, getting to know people. It's a wonderful thing. We're doing another one in August. And it's usually August and January. Sometimes we do a third one in the spring. And it's a really great way for people who are at any stage in their journey to get to be with other people who are having similar experiences.
It's well attended?
The one in summer is larger. It can be anywhere from 50 to 70 people. And in the winter, it's smaller. It's around 30 people. And it always fills up. Actually, the summer one is already full. But it's, if you're in this area, it's pretty close to go to. And it's geared4transmission.org.
Say that again?
It's geared4transmission.org.
How did you get recruited to be on the leadership?
So I went on a couple of retreats, and the then leader and I got to know each other, and he was ready to step down. He kind of got burnt out, and he was trying to gather a new team but wasn't really able to. I have a lot of experience with nonprofit leadership and organizational stuff, and so I gathered some people and to form a team, and so we took over. And so there are 7 of us now, and we're working on creating a sustainable plan so that these retreats can go on for the future.
Is there anything for people who are transitioning to female?
There is. There's Gender Odyssey is one, and there's another one. I think it's, there's several. Something else to know locally is the Trans Life Conference. It's a conference, not a retreat, but it's open to anybody who's trans. They have a community conference, a one-day conference, and then they have a professional conference. So the community is for people who are in the process of transition, and the professional conference is for people who are providers, whether they be psychologists or doctors or social workers or people who are service providers.
So not necessarily trans themselves.
They could be, but they not necessarily at all. Uh-huh.
Yep. And when are they? Do you have dates for those?
I don't have dates for those.
If people were interested, they would just look up
They
trans
can look
life?
Up Trans Life, yeah, okay. And it's Sonoma County. So.
A lot of happenings here in Sonoma County.
There are. There's actually a very active, vibrant trans community in Sonoma County.
Do you see yourself, Maxwell? Do you see yourself speaking at a conference someday soon?
I co-facilitated one of the workshops at the Trans Life Conference last year.
Which one?
The Trans Masculine Affinity Group. I helped to facilitate that. It's just a hour long session, just affinity group session. People were talking about where they were at and asking questions and that kind of thing.
Okay, so, could you tell us a little bit about your new blooming relationship?
Sure. We've been together for 1 year and 3 months, and it's been wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I'm having a great time. And what else to say? I moved to Petaluma a few months ago, so we're living together now, and we're having a wonderful time.
So nice to see you. You look great.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, it's,
embodied, right?
Living as the authentic me that I'm meant to live has been a huge thing and has made my life actually really great. Mm-hmm. And I feel truly happy in a way that I haven't ever felt. Yeah.
The word is stunning that's coming up in my brain. It's just stunning. It's wonderful to hear that. You look like a bright light.
Thank you. You just emit
lightness and realness happiness joy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel it. I feel it. Yeah. I feel it.
So I have two questions for you to finish up our interview.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, I have a friend who's in her 70s and her grandchild, who was born male, told his parents, her daughter, at 3 years old that he was a girl. And they allow her to live as a girl. All her friends are girls. The school knows she's a girl. She's like 11 now. She's turned 11, 10 or 11. And I've asked my friend, would you come on the show and talk about your granddaughter? And she said, why? What's to talk about? She's my daughter, my granddaughter. And there's like nothing else to say about that. So I'm wondering if you can understand that position.
I can. I mean, I totally can. I think, you know, as I was saying at the very beginning, when I describe my life as simple, it's just, this is who I am. And, you know, I have, because I transitioned later and because I have a lot of history and I have a lot of, you know, it's like I'm also older and so I've seen how history has moved. I have more to say, but the truth is I'm just a guy and I'm just who I'm meant to be. And it, there isn't really, I mean, I can totally see why there wouldn't be anything to say because her granddaughter is just her granddaughter and that's just who she is and that's her life, you know.
Yeah, I can understand that, but I think it would be educational because this is what our show is about. I mean, you've really been educating us and the audience.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, I have a different opinion. I think it's, I mean, I understand what you're saying.
Right.
I'm not debating you or anything, but I just, we need educators. We need to be visible.
I mean,
we need,
think because of the way society is right now, we're in process. We're in, and so the more people know about this and the more people can accept it, the better off we are. So yes, I agree there that education is important. And I also understand this perspective because it just is, you know.
And one last question. Words of wisdom to anyone listening out there and whatever you want them to know.
I think being your authentic self is the most freeing and joyful experience you can have. And I think it doesn't matter whether it's about gender or about sexuality or about what things you like, or it doesn't matter what it's about. It doesn't, it just, like, living into that authenticity, finding out what it is incredible. And I think we cut ourselves off from so much when we're trying to conform to what we think society, you know, what we think society wants us to be, or what our family wants us to be, or what our partner wants us to be, or our husband, or our wife, or whatever, you know, our kids, or whatever. And I think that we actually get to, there's more space in our lives to do good things when we can actually be who we really are, no matter what it is.
Beautiful.
That's my wisdom for today.
Authenticity.
Yes.
I'm a believer.
We're so glad you're with us, Maxwell.
Thank you for having me.
We want you to remember that, like Max, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can support others in being courageous and living their lives authentically. It's another way to help the world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then, good night.
Ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop.
Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Cheryl Cabanuck. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB FM Radio 91. The Santa Rosa Junior College's Community Education Program is offering a three-part Key Moments in LGBT History course this fall at the Fountain Grove Lodge on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon starting November 2nd. The class is open to the public, and you can register and learn more at santarosa.edu.
So many answers, I don't know.
On air, online, or on the go, you're listening to KRCB-FM Windsor and K215-CQ Santa Rosa. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop is next.